I've changed up the plan yet again. I was looking at where we need to be for Sunday. And Sunday is actually assigned only one chapter. And so I thought instead of doing three chapters tonight, rushing through three chapters, we'd split it two and two. So I'll do two chapters tonight, kind of three actually. We'll talk about it in a sec. But mainly two chapters tonight, and then we'll do 14 and 15 on Sunday, and that'll give us a little more time for discussion, less of a breakneck speed, and then we'll be caught up on Sunday morning with our schedule. Sunday, we talked about Job's response to Bildad's speech, which was full of a lot of despair. He accuses God of marking him, focusing his attentions on him to torment him. Job talks about how he feels cornered, that if he's declared innocent, his sufferings will continue because he's already suffering and he's already innocent. And if he raises his head up to approach God or to acknowledge God or try to call out to him, he's only afraid that God will focus on him all the more, that he'll expose himself to more torments. And the words he uses is, if I hold my head high, you'll hunt me like a lion, is a word Job uses. And then chapter 10 ends pretty melancholic. Verses 18 through 22, why did you bring me out from the womb? Would that I had died before any eye had seen me, and were as though I had not been, carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Then cease and leave me alone, that I may find a little cheer before I go. And I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of gloom like thick darkness, the deep shadow without any order, where light is as thick as darkness. Obviously, Job is in a state of despair still. Very bleak outlook on the circumstances, and even the relief of death he sees as only going into darkness. Darkness so thick that light can't penetrate it. So in Job's mind, there's no hope or relief or restoration that he can see where this all leads to. We read chapter 11, and I kind of gave some highlights in the last 5 minutes of class. We'll read through it again, and if you guys have some comments you want to make on it, we'll talk about it for just a few minutes again. But then we'll spend the bulk of tonight in chapter 12 and 13, the beginning of Job's response to Zophar. Chapter 11. Then Zophar the Namathite answered and said, should a multitude of words go unanswered, and a man full of talk be judged right? Should your babble silence men, and when you mock, shall no one shame you? For you say, my doctrine is pure, and I am clean in God's eyes. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, and that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. Can you find out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limit of the Almighty? It is higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If he passes through and imprisons and summons the court, who can turn him back? For he knows worthless men, and when he sees iniquity, will he not consider it? But a stupid man will get understanding when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. If you prepare your heart, you will stretch out your hands toward him. If iniquity is in your hand, put it far away, and let not injustice dwell in your tents. Surely then you will lift up your face without blemish, you will be secure and will not fear, you will forget your misery, you will remember it as waters that have passed away, and your life will be brighter than the noonday. Its darkness will be like the morning. And you will feel secure because there is hope. You will look around and take your rest in security. You will lie down and none will make you afraid. Many will court your favor, but the eyes of the wicked will fail. All way of escape will be lost to them, and their hope is to breathe their last. So Zophar has some pretty harsh words for Job. just to reiterate, kind of one of the main features of this speech is Zophar acknowledging and expounding on the wisdom and greatness of God and saying that it's beyond understanding. And then immediately after that, in verse 6, acting like he knows the full circumstances of Job, saying, you deserve more suffering than what you're getting. So he presumes not only that Job is guilty, but he presumes that almost to know what Job is guilty of, in a sense, if you can quantify the amount of suffering he's going through and say, actually, you deserve more, you must think you know what he's done. And actually, as we get further along, they will start listing things that Job has apparently done based on his sufferings. So that was one of the main features of the speech, that probably the main thing to pull out of here. But anyone have any of their own thoughts they wanted to share about Zophar's speech? Yeah.
From there forward,
mm-hmm. Right, yeah. If you didn't hear Rob, he was talking about verse 13 and towards the end of the chapter, really, that whole section where Zophar is giving Job actually good advice, compassionate advice of seek restoration with God, repent and turn to him. Prepare your heart, stretch out your hand toward him. And that generally is good advice, especially that first part, when stretch out your hand toward God. But unfortunately, Zophar is talking about it in the context of, you've sinned, and I know you've sinned, therefore stretch out your hand toward God, put your iniquity away. But it does suggest, acknowledge that his friends do want to help him. They're trying to get him to this place of restoration. They care about him. They just have very strong opinions of what's going on, ill-informed opinions. Anything else about Zophar's speech? An idiom.
Yes, an idiom.
Yeah.
And he kind of says it this way, a stupid man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep. Right. Right. Yeah, so Chip's talking about verse 12, where Zophar expresses a Hebrew idiom of basically something impossible happening. Chip used the example of when pigs fly. And that is the meaning behind the idiom of, you know, you'll get understanding when a wild donkey's colt is born a man. It's never going to happen for a stupid person. And Chip interpreted that as basically an accusation against Job, that that's how dumb Job is. And especially when you look at verse 11, for he, God, knows worthless men. When he sees iniquity, will he not consider it? That's, in Zophar's mind, the exact situation Job is in. God has seen a man with iniquity, and he's considered it and has led to these sufferings. So I think Chip's on the right path of Zophar's kind of talking about this wicked man, this hypothetical, but obviously who he has in mind is Job. That's the subject of this discourse, Job and why he's going through what he's going through. Yeah. Right, like probably the most significant example that comes to my mind is like natural disasters. God's punishing this people or America with this hurricane because of this sin. And yeah, you're absolutely right. You have to be, this is a good example of being, you need to be careful when you attribute God's intentions to him. Job's going to go on and say that you're speaking falsely on God's behalf, which is probably the worst possible way to speak falsely when you make assumptions like that. Even if it's true in some way that we would never even know, it's still not safe to do it because you don't know for sure. Yeah.
We want it to make sense. Right. Right?
Absolutely. So, well, that's an excellent point. We want so badly to be able to attribute atrocities for the correct reasons and have a reasoning behind it and understand it. And Job's going to say to his friends, you're being way too simplistic. Like, it is apparent that Job had that way of thinking. That's why he's struggling with this in the first place, trying to understand. But he's starting to get it's not that simple. And I'm angry that it's not that simple, but at least I've come to the understanding that it's not that simple, and that's where he wants his three friends to come to. Rob, and then we'll move on. So that, let me see. So that's a very different translation from at least the ESV. And so since I haven't familiarize myself with it. I can't explain. ESV, oh, that God would speak and open his lips to you, that he would tell you the secrets of wisdom. For he is manifold in understanding. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. The two sides of wisdom, NIV wording it like that, instead of saying the secrets of wisdom, the two sides of wisdom, it could be the manifold, it could be the nuance of wisdom. So when we look at Proverbs, a proverb isn't absolutely true 100% of the time. So that means that not only is a proverb a piece of wisdom, but it takes wisdom to know how to use that piece of wisdom. And so that could be part of what Zophar is getting at, is that the tools of wisdom, how we use them and apply them, those are the secrets of wisdom that God knows completely and thoroughly, that we don't always know. We can look at a proverb and try and decide, does this work in my situation? My favorite example is, answer a fool according to his folly. Next verse, do not answer a fool according to his folly. And it's like, okay, so what do I do? But it just suggests that you have to have wisdom to use wisdom, and that could be part of that idea of the two sides of wisdom. That would be my guess. And then, yeah, and then ESV kind of takes it differently. God's forgotten some of your sins, and as God's exacting of you less than you deserve, as if he's forgotten some of them, but not in a forgiving way. It almost sounds like just like happenstance. I've forgotten some of them. Maybe I'll get around to those. Yeah, there's so many, which I know is true for me. So, all right, with that, we'll move into chapter 12. Job begins his response, and it goes through 14. Like I said, we'll try to get through 12 and 13 today, and then tackle 14 Sunday, and Eliphaz's second speech, chapter 15, on Sunday. We'll read chapter 12. And then Job answered and said, no doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. But I have understanding as well as you. I am not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these? I am a laughingstock to my friends, I who called to God, and he answered me. A just and blameless man am a laughingstock. In the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune. It is ready for those whose feet slip. The tents of robbers are at peace, and those who provoke God are secure, who bring their God in their hand. But ask the heart, or ask the beasts, and they will teach you, the birds of the heavens, and they will tell you, or the bushes of the earth, and they will teach you, and the fish of the sea will declare to you, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every living thing, and the breath of all mankind. Does not the ear test words as the palate tastes food? Wisdom is with the aged, and understanding in length of days. With God are wisdom and might. He has counsel and understanding. If he tears down, none can rebuild. If he shuts a man in, none can open. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the land. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away stripped, and judges he makes fools. He looses the bonds of kings and binds a waistcloth on their hips. He leads priests away stripped and overthrows the mighty. He deprives of speech those who are trusted and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on princes and loosens the belt of the strong. He uncovers the deeps out of darkness and brings deep darkness to light. He makes nations great and he destroys them. He enlarges nations and leads them away. He takes away understanding from the chiefs of the people of the earth and makes them wander in a trackless waste. They grope in the dark without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. So in the first three verses, Job sarcastically challenges his three friends. Like we have pointed out, basically all of the friends' speeches start out with insults. So Job is taking a cue from them and insulting them in return. He says, you are the people, which can be read as Job accusing his three friends as seeing themselves as the elite owners of wisdom. They're the culmination of wisdom, and they have the answers. Surely you are the people with the answers. And that idea is reinforced by his next remark, which is thick with sarcasm, and that is, wisdom will die with you. Job asserts that he's not inferior to them in wisdom. He is just as wise as them, if not wiser. And as a reminder, and it's going to keep coming up, Trimper Longman, somebody who wrote a commentary on the book of Job, I took this quote from him. He said, "We must remember that the disputations are really about who has wisdom. Wisdom is what is needed to diagnose Job's problem and to determine the remedy." So that's why wisdom and who has wisdom, who doesn't have wisdom, who lacks wisdom, that's why that keeps coming up as an idea. Because they're hoping that wisdom will answer what's going on in the situation. Then Job asks, "Who does not know such things as these?" And it's, that makes it sound like Job is accusing them of just repeating platitudes without actually trying to understand or deeply examine Job's particular situation. They're not saying anything new or helpful. They're just repeating teachings that they've understood their whole lives from generations past. And so Job's saying, "Yeah, I everything you're saying, I've heard, I know. You're not adding anything to this conversation. You're not adding to my understanding." In verses 4 through 6, Job laments that he has become a laughingstock of friends, although he is blameless and innocent. And in verse 5, Job explicitly calls out his friends for their lack of empathy, their hastiness to falsely accuse him, and in their comfort and ease, they only feel contempt for Job's sufferings. And that's from verse 5. "In the thought of one who is at ease, there is contempt for misfortune. It is ready for those whose feet slip." People are well-adjusted, secure, and someone close to them suffers through something. That security they feel can turn into a lack of empathy for someone who's not in security. You know, I'm making the right choices, so my life's correct and secure and the way it's supposed to be going. Obviously, you've done something wrong. You've messed up somehow. Your choices have resulted in the situation you're in. Not realizing that that person is only secure because God has preserved that for them. And even through the poor choices they have made, they've somehow escaped sufferings. And so that's the idea Job is accusing his friends of in verse 5. In verse 6, Job contradicts Zophar's claim that only those in right standing with God are secure. Job asserts that even the wicked will dwell in security. Verses 7 through 12, Job uses analogies drawn from nature, which I've repeated every time we see it, but it's just reinforcing this idea that we are looking at wisdom literature, and wisdom is at the heart of what is being discussed in this book. And Job also acknowledges the sovereignty of God. He has done all these things, including inflicting Job with sufferings. Verses 13 through 25. This is another interesting thing that's already happened once in the book. In chapter 9, if you remember, Job uses a form of Hebrew hymn that's usually reserved for hymns of praise, praising God for his creative power. And in chapter 9, he used that form of hymn to describe God's destructive power. He does the same thing in verses 13 through 25, describing how God is destructive, that his choices cannot be changed or moved. And the point of the hymn is to describe God's ultimate authority and sovereignty in matters of humanity. And although Job acknowledges God's wisdom and sovereignty, he focuses on how God employs these attributes in destructive ways, not constructive ways. And each example in verses 14 through 25 is a negative of something happening to someone, of a nation being destroyed, and things like that, not a positive outcome for people. And again, in my mind, that points to kind of the genius of the person who wrote the book, who took these ideas that Job gave and framed them in a Hebrew poetic way, but also kind of put a twist on the normal Hebrew poetry and ideas of Hebrew literature. I just think that's really incredible. So that's my quick summary of chapter 12. Any comments or thoughts? Well, right. Rob is talking about the circumstances of Job as an example of suffering and how we think about people who are suffering, how we treat them. I always come back to the idea of this, two of the most extreme examples of suffering are servants of God. It's Job and it's Jesus. And a third runner-up for me would be Joseph, Job especially, because we get the most explicit dialogue and inner thought of what's going on with him. Faithful servant to God, rails against God, questioning him, accusing him in some moments, showing despair and emotion. But in the end of everything, when God comes down onto the scene and corrects everyone's thinking, Job is still regarded as faithful, as not having said anything that was sinful towards God. He didn't presume anything on God's part. He knew that this, in terms of human understanding, wasn't just because he hadn't done anything to merit it, but he didn't try to explain why, like his friends did, and, you know, speak falsely on God's behalf. It's an incredible example of a faithful servant suffering and being allowed to express that anger and rage and that being okay. Encourage. Sam?
Yeah, I completely agree.
Sam was talking about how Job is taking off his gloves towards his friends, especially in their attitude. He's mentioned it a couple times before how they're lacking in their comfort toward him, but here he's really explicitly going at them for their prideful attitude. And yeah, like you said, he acknowledges in verse 12, there is wisdom in length of days. And in verse 20, but just like in this situation, the wisdom of the elders can't always make sense of things. God can frustrate that wisdom and that understanding. And the proper response is to be humbled by that, not to go on spouting platitudes, acting like you know what God is thinking, what God is doing. No, it's not. It's right. 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 Yeah, I can relate to that. When it's easy to assume that when someone comes to you and describes a problem to you, you revert back to being in school and you're like, okay, I'm presented with a problem. I have to answer it. I have to solve it. And in reality, most relationships are, I'm telling you my problem to get it out there, to get it off my chest. And I don't want you to fix it. Tell me what to do. The goal is to just have someone be there present. All right, with that, we're going to continue into chapter 13. Behold, my eye has seen all this, my ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue my case with God. As for you, you whitewash with lies. Worthless physicians are you all. Oh, that you would keep silent, and it would be your wisdom. Hear now my argument and listen to the pleadings of my lips. Will you speak falsely for God and speak deceitfully for him? Will you show partiality toward him? Will you plead the case for God? Will it be well with you when he searches you out? Or can you deceive him as one deceives a man? He will surely rebuke you if in secret you show partiality. Will not his majesty terrify you and the dread of him fall upon you? Your maxims are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay. Let me have silence and I will speak, and let come on me what may. Why should I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hand? Though he slay me, I will hope in him. Yet I will argue my ways to his face. This will be my salvation, that the godless shall not come before him. Keep listening to my words and let my declaration be in your ears. Behold, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be in the right. Who is there who will contend with me? For when I would be silent and die, for then I would be silent and die. Only grant me two things. Then I will not hide myself from your face. Withdraw your hand from me and let not dread of you terrify me. Then call, and I will answer, or let me speak, and you reply to me. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and count me as your enemy? Will you frighten a driven leaf and pursue dry chaff? For you write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks and watch all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet. Man wastes away like a rotten thing, like a garment. I meant to stop in verse 27 because verse 28 actually belongs. But that's okay. So chapter 13, Job levels his friends with a multitude of criticisms, venting his frustration with them. In verses 1 through 5, Job begins to confront his friends about how swiftly they have come to their conclusions and spoken for God. Verse 1, Job affirms his observations as based on experience. And in verse 3, Job reiterates his desire to plead his case before God. And that's just another example of the state of mind Job is in, that he keeps going back and forth between, I really want to confront God and air out my grievances with him. Also, I'm terrified of him, and if I expose myself, he's just going to torment me more. But I've prepared my case for him, and this is what I would say to him if I had a chance. But I'm really scared to talk to him, so please, God, stop tormenting me so I can speak to you. He's definitely seeking this option, this opportunity to actually speak to God and discuss with him what's going on. But he's also terrified of what acknowledges that God is so superior to him. Would he even care? I had a chance to air out my grievances. Then in verse 4, you whitewash with lies. And whitewash refers to the process of applying a paste or something like that to repair something that is cracked or damaged, like pottery. So Job is accusing his three friends of applying simplistic arguments and thoughts in an attempt to solve a problem that is too complicated. And what's worse, they're using falsehoods to do it. So that goes back to the idea of his friends are just clinging on to these simplistic black and white views of the world. Rather than being challenged by their righteous friend suffering, they're assuming that that friend is not righteous, that he is wicked, and that's why he's suffering, and that's the end all be all, end of it, no discussion, reason for what's going on. And Job is saying, that's way too simplistic. I haven't. In verse 5, he says it would be more wise for his friends to be quiet rather than to continue speaking and try to find answers for why he's suffering. And Job could be roundabout accusing them of being foolish. In Proverbs 17:28, it says, even fools are thought wise if they keep silent. Verses 6 through 12, Job accuses them of speaking falsely of God, attempting to speak on behalf of God without possibly having enough wisdom to do so. In these verses, especially, Job continues to use the terminology of a courtroom. He wishes to present his argument in verse 6. Verse 7, his friends are giving false testimony. Verse 8, they are making a case for God. Verse 10, they're showing partiality. And so that idea of a courtroom, that this is a court, there are defenders, prosecutors, hopefully there's a mediator somewhere, and there's a judge. That idea continues to play out throughout the book. In verse 11 of chapter 13, will not his majesty terrify you and the dread of him fall upon you? It seems like Job is asking how seriously they take the majesty and power of God. They've been speaking on the majesty and power of God themselves, and he's asking, do you really take that seriously? If you took that seriously, wouldn't you hesitate before speaking for him, for acting like you know his intentions and his thoughts and the reasons for why he's doing these things? If you really believed he was that powerful, would you be acting like this? Verse 12, Job says his friends' arguments are without substance. They're merely surface-level platitudes without any reason. In verses 13 through 19, Job turns his attention towards God. In verse 15, it says, though he slay me, I will hope in him. And it's possible that the English translation, I will hope in him, gives a optimism that's actually not there. The Hebrew could also be translated as, though he slay me, I will wait for him. Which kind of just adds to this idea of no matter what comes, I'm going to get my case before him. I'm going to speak to him and confront him about these things. In verses 18 through 19, Job holds fast to his integrity and establishing out the chapter. Job addresses his complaint to God directly again. In verses 20 through 25, he has two requests of God, that he withdraw his hand from Job to put an end to his sufferings, which is something he said, if God would do that, then he would speak to God, maybe. And then after that request, he says, give me an audience with you. Whether I call for you and you come to me, or you call for me and I come to you, just let me speak to you. And when I speak to you, I have two questions for you. What is my sin? Why do you torment me? I think that's the point of the verses, the questions in verse 23. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. If indeed this is suffering because I have actually done something, then would you just tell me what it is so I can actually repent of it? Job's not going to repent of something he hasn't done, and so he'd like God to just explicitly tell him, reveal to him, what is it that he's suffering for. In verse 25, will you frighten a driven leaf and pursue dry chaff? God continue to fixate on someone who is so trivial and insignificant. That was a lot of talking. I'm sorry, they're long chapters, and I wanted to get at least some sort of concrete idea of what's going on. Any comments before Toss is up?
Same.
Yeah.
He was spending a lot of
right. Right, yeah. So verse 23, tell me what my sin is. Yeah, like you said, it is probably the first time where he's actually acknowledging, okay, maybe I did do something. Maybe something is going on here. And like you said, you'd think that his friends would be like, okay, all right, now we've broken through. Now we've got some common ground we can work with. But they almost take that to mean, oh, I'll tell you what you've done, Job. And then they list all these things that Job has actually never done. So rather than taking it as some sort of sincere plead for just please let me know what's going on, they see it as an opportunity to accuse him of all.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they weren't so zealous to figure out why this was going on, would Job be so zealous in his anger and frustration towards God? Because not only is he suffering, but on top of that, he's being accused of all these things. And so that spurred any of us to say, okay, God, come down here and tell them that this isn't true. Tell them that I am innocent. Establish this without a doubt rather than allowing them to continue to harass me. I think you got last minute comments before we close out. Sorry I talked so much, but I wanted to make sure we get to where we need to be on Sunday, and we don't continue the cycle of being behind. Thank you for your attention and for your comments.